It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod. This episode recorded on August 17th, 2023. And on this episode of the Barry Pod, my guest is Diane McBride.
Hello, that is me.
Hello. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I like to do two different kinds of pod episodes. One I call a personality pod, where it's just about a person I find interesting. And then the other is an issue pod. And you're the first pod guest. I'm going to try and combine them both.
Okay.
Because you are a personality I find interesting.
Thank you.
And there are some issues that I think we can chat about that are timely.
I would love that.
All right. Let's begin on the personality side. First, you grew up in Southern California.
I did.
Mm-hmm. And I always like to ask theater people, when was your epiphany about live theater and performance, acting and singing, whatever it was? Everybody has that moment where your brain lights up and you say, this is what I have to do.
This is a terrible part of my personality. So let's go ahead and start with that. So this is a thing you and I share, is that we were both soccer players, and I really thought soccer was going to be sort of the thing that I did, but you know, I was that first generation soccer player, so there was no real path for me. And I'd always been in choir and always been a singer. So I was in ninth grade, and you know, I was actively playing still, but I started getting interested in this other world of theater and whatnot. And so I was too nervous to audition for my musical at school. I had never done a musical, and I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this. So I asked my choir teacher, I was like, can I be in the show? And they were doing The King and I, and let's not judge, because it was the 80s. And so I was in The King and I. And I had literally been in the theater for 2 days. And we were in rehearsal, and I'm down on the ground, and I'm praising Buddha. And the senior who is playing Anna is delivering her lines. And I literally have my head on the ground, and I peek up, and I look at her, and I think to myself, ugh, I could do it so much better. And at that point, I was just like, this is what I'm going to do. And then I just took over, and I took off. And that was pretty much the point. I mean, I had other points where I'd be singing, and I was like, God, this feels good. But that was just one of those things that just came as clear as it possibly could. Like, wow.
You had found your thing.
I'd found it. And I don't know where that confidence or that hubris came from. I mean, and it was just as strong as could be of like, no, that is a terrible line reading. So there it is.
Have I ever told you my very similar story?
No, from like let's hear grade? It.
Well, I won't waste the pod time. I'll tell you off the air.
Okay. As bad as that?
It's very similar to that in a certain way.
Capricorns.
There you go.
Here we are.
There you go. And that's why we rule the world. So now,
yeah.
Moving on. So from that point, freshman in high school, you did school stuff.
Yeah.
At some point, you decided to major in theater and performance.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I grew up in Riverside. I don't know if that's lucky, but I grew up in Riverside, and we had a huge theater in town called Riverside Civic Light Opera, which is now Performance Riverside. And it was actually based at the community college. And I was dating the artistic director's son, which is, you know, always a good way in.
Smooth.
Yeah, thank you. And so I started working professionally when I was a senior in high school. So, you know, those 3 years, I really took theater and music very seriously. So I started working when I was a senior in high school at the Civic Light Opera, and I finished my associate degree there, and then I went to Cal State Fullerton, which at that point, there were only 3 musical theater majors in the United States. And Fullerton, you know, is right next to Disneyland, Magic Mountain, Hollywood, all of that stuff. So it was a really intense and great program. And a lot of people from my program are still working. It was a really practical program, sort of like a conservatory model. And now, like, sometimes I look at that program and I think, God, could I get into this program? It's right. So hard, the BFA. So we were sort of guinea pigs, which was cool.
Yeah. So there were only three colleges offering a major in musical theater in the whole country?
I think it was a school in Washington, D.C., Fullerton, and someplace else. And I know that there was a master's degree at Irvine. And now you can't not find that major. Mm-hmm. It's just everywhere. I think people have realized that you have to have all of those talents if you want to do musical theater, if you want to do theater.
So when we're while we're on the topic of musical theater, you've had a career full of big roles. You've just done a couple of big roles.
Yeah.
Mountain Play, Dolly Levi, right?
Yeah.
Was the most recent?
Yeah.
Mama Rose.
Yeah.
Just before that in Gypsy. There's a couple of the like...
After. I did Dolly, then I did Gypsy.
Okay.
But the Mountain Play for Dolly outside, and then the Mountain Play inside for Rose, which was... You know, couldn't be more different that you went from 4,000 seats to 99 seats.
Right.
So
those are the big marquee parts for women in theater. Are there other shows? I've only known you about 10 years, maybe.
Right.
Are there other shows, though, that were more important to you, more peak experience than those parts?
Well, I have loved my time at Lucky Penny that we've spent together, and I feel like I've gotten to play some of the great roles there, you know, getting to do Cuckoo's Nest with you and play Nurse Ratched, which was fantastic. I loved playing Desiree in Little Night Music. Those are roles that I adore. But yeah, I have a list, you know. I'd love to do Drowsy Chaperone. I'd love to do Sunset Boulevard. I'd love to do Sweeney Todd. And at this point, you know, I really want the project to be interesting. It's not so much about having to work constantly. I mean, that's nice. But I don't mind taking something smaller if I find it to be interesting, if I trust the production, if it's... And sometimes, you know, when you have to run that whole show, I mean, you're an actor too, so when you have everything on you, it dominates your life, and it takes over, and you can't go out, and you can't drink, and you can't talk loud, or, you know, go to any place that you have to yell. So... You're really giving your whole life over to that kind of show. So I don't mind sometimes playing something smaller where the whole thing is not on my shoulders, but it has to be a show that, it has to be a company and a show that I feel safe and, you know, it's fun and it's professional. I don't need to just do it to do it.
Yeah. So have you managed to earn a living with your theater training and skills in performing and teaching for your essentially your entire adult life? Or did you have other jobs?
Well, I have men who pay for my... No, just kidding. I do luckily have a husband who's got a really great job, thank God. No, I was a waitress for 10 years, but I was always a waitress at a theme restaurant. So I always thought it was acting. So my first waitressing job was at a 50s diner, and I played this character named Toots. And it was weird because I learned to choreograph there, and you stayed in character. And so that was great. And then I moved to a 40s diner where I took that character with me. And so I played her there. And then when I moved to San Francisco, I worked at Max's Opera Cafe.
Okay.
And, you know, which is totally exhilarating and completely humiliating. So there's nothing like, you know, trying to sing with ketchup on you. but every place that I worked was a place that I could perform. And that was important, I guess, you know, and it made waitressing less complicated. And then I transitioned into being a theater teacher. Well, I'd always been a theater teacher. I started teaching when I was about 18. Again, like, how did I know that? I went from, you know, 14 to 18 and teaching people how to act. Like, I didn't really know anything. I just completely faked it.
but somehow you did know.
I think I knew.
Somehow you had an instinct of what works and what doesn't and why you can't do it this way and you have to do it that way.
Yeah. I look back on some of those lessons and I'm like, oh... Thank you, parents, for paying hundreds of dollars for me to teach your children things that I was working out, right?
Yeah, right.
But then I transitioned into being a teacher and ran a lot of programs. So I ran the school at 42nd Street Moon in San Francisco. I created their education department there. And I'm a professor now at Las Positas College, a part-time professor. And I pretty much get to do theater, film, TV, voiceover, podcasts. I am being paid thousands today.
Oh,
I just
yeah.
want people to know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a crazy thing. You know, it's boom or bust sometimes, and you go through really dry spells, and you go through periods where, you know, you've got more than you can handle. And it's been weird post-pandemic of everything sort of coming back. You know that as well as I do, of the world has shifted and changed. But yeah, I feel really lucky that this is what I get to do. And you have to do the hustle. You got to find what's out there, and you've got to be willing to sort of gig and do some humiliating things and work background occasionally. But it's what I chose.
And you can be decades into a successful career and still have to grovel into an audition
yeah.
situation
yeah.
and maybe be humiliated.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest names in the business are still out there reading for parts.
Yeah.
We don't see that necessarily.
Yeah. I was actually just talking to my girlfriend from New York today, and she auditions for a lot of Broadway things, and she's still, you know, contacting assistant casting directors and being like, what could I do? And how did this go? And I have to do follow-up emails. You send things out, because I direct a lot too, right? So, you know, I'll send my resume out, awards and reviews and everything, and silence. And then you follow up. Hello, just making sure you got my resume. Silence, right? And it might be 2 years that someone's like, hey, I got your resume 2 years ago. And it's like, well, oh, thanks. You know, and but you do, and you have to have some backbone to just keep knocking at the door. And you also, I think a lot of people who audition for film and TV, they feel this way. It's a little different with theater, but because that's more personal, but film and TV, like, you send that stuff out, you may never get a response. You know, you just film it and you forget it. And I remember, you know, when we used to go to a lot of in-person auditions for film and TV, I would just go in basically to see my friends and have a good cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And I would be like, if that works, great.
It's a good attitude.
You know, and it feels that way in the pandemic when you were auditioning for things online. And, you know, the unions had to regulate some of that stuff because you really felt like you were shouting into the void, and it was getting really frustrating to have no feedback. Theater does a very different thing, that you get feedback. You get feedback in the room. Generally, a casting director will contact you and have some manners, and it's hard,
yeah.
You know?
So you mentioned the unions, and here's where we can segue from personality to issues for
okay.
a moment. Right now, we've got two strikes going on in
yeah.
Hollywood. The Writers Guild went out first, and then the SAG-AFTRA, Screen Actors Guild, hyphen, Association of Federated Television and Radio.
Correct, AFTRA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're a member of SAG-AFTRA.
Yes.
And of Actors Equity, the
yes.
stage union, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's your take on, focus on SAG-AFTRA and the strike, what's your take on all of it? What are you hearing from your side as a union member?
I've really been trying to follow this, and it's crazy because Fran Drescher has become like the hero that we didn't know that we needed. She is formidable and clear and direct. And I was just filling out my ballot this week, and I was really trying not to be lazy. Sometimes I'm like, I know these people, I'll vote for them. But I really read through all of the candidates, and I was trying to make sure that I was picking people who were completely on the front line of human talent, because AI is real. And I'm not trying to be, you know, a non-technological person, because that's also revolutionized our industry, and it's amazing. I don't want to use a typewriter, you know, like, technology is good. But AI for actors is a really dangerous thing. The thing that they're talking about now is taking a background performer, that you do one gig as a background performer, and that they own your likeness in perpetuity forever with this company, which has already sort of been happening, that they'll take a group of actors, and this has been happening without your consent. and they've been duplicating you. Like, you look at crowd scenes in Star Wars and look at some things, and you know, that's AI generated background. And you know, the humanness of what we do, you know, you're a broadcaster. It's your voice. It's your voice as a musician. It's your voice as a writer. You're a writer. You know, I'm just not interested. I'm not interested in losing the human quality of storytelling and the having robot overlords take over what we do. Yeah, they can. It's great. But nobody's going to have the experiences that a human has. A robot is not going to have that. They will not know how you felt in fourth grade. They're not going to know the story of your aunt and your dog and all of the things that are personal and come from you. And I'm sorry, they might get really good at background talent and generated talent, you know, on camera. You know, they're talking about being able to take someone's likeness and have like some of these marquee, you know, Marvel, Star Wars, and I'm a Star Wars fan, so I'm not trying to say that, but like being able to use their faces forever so that, you know, you can have Carrie Fisher for forever and ever, but you have to ask yourself who owns you. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to get a gig, one gig. You go to hundreds of auditions to get one gig. It's even hard to get background work. So it's like, now I'm never going to work and you're not going to pay me? And I'm still going to have to pay my dues for what? Right? And it's something that I think people, all people, not just actors and artists and inventors and creators, it's everybody. There's no toll takers anymore. And it's always happened, right? We've always had innovation that have taken jobs, right? But you sort of hear in America, you know, people being mad at other humans taking their jobs. It's not other humans taking your jobs. It's robots that are taking your jobs. And it's an economic divide. When you look at the salaries of people at Netflix, you know, they've said flat out to actors, we will wait until we starve you out. And I feel like that's got to be a social cry to the world of like, we can't let 10 people rule an industry. It's not good for our country. And, you know, we're already seeing what happens when people are out of work. We want more of this. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm extremely passionate about this issue. And I'm really inspired, actually, about all the people that are striking and staying with it. And that it's still a topic because artists know how to be unemployed. You know, we'll stay. We'll keep doing it. I heard this other actor the other day. It said, I had 12 jobs before this. Now I'll have 13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of stunning the transition, how quickly some of this has happened. There was a story going around about I believe it was a female background actor getting her body, full body scan and all this stuff that she didn't know was in the contract. They're not telling people what's going on. So there's a little deceptiveness, I think, in the way they're going.
I feel like your contracts need to be like a GMO label. Mm. Like, you know, this is an AI label and you need to know what you're getting yourself into. Mm. And, you know, we've been dealing with this issue for a long time in terms of the internet. And this is really what SAG-AFTRA is trying to stay on top of. I remember a long time ago when I was doing some work for Yahoo. And I was doing banner ads for Yahoo. And they didn't even have a new media contract at this point. So I was still being paid like under a print ad, even though I was moving. And I was being seen thousands and thousands of times a day on a Yahoo site, right? And they didn't know how to navigate how to pay for this. And this is in the early 2000s. So this kind of stuff has, you know, it's come to a head where people are finally like, man, and it happened in the record industry too, where, you know, this people got ahead of this before the sort of common people and the workers were really aware of what was happening. And I think now everyone's like, okay, we've got to get a handle on streaming. We've got to get a handle on the internet and how we are paid.
Yeah. And to transition from that on-camera world to the live theater world, there's a whole different struggle going on in live theater you're well aware of. But in the last few months, it's changed from the pandemic was really difficult for live theater, to maybe the pandemic has broken live theater in a way that we've never seen in our generations. Three notable examples. The first one was Ashland, Oregon Shakespeare.
Yeah.
As the story goes, put out an appeal. We need $2.5 million, I think it was, to get through the season.
Yep.
And 2 or 3 months later, they achieved that goal and immediately said, actually, we need another $7 million. Shocking numbers, you know. And then Center Stage, right? At LA.
At the Mark Taper.
Mark Taper. They've completely shut down programming in the Mark Taper Theater, which is the biggest one in LA, the highest profile one in LA, right?
Yeah.
And then part three to this, and I've been cataloging and sending people, you know, have you seen this one kind of messages, TheaterWorks.
Yep.
Now, if you're a theater goer in the Bay Area, you may know TheaterWorks. They're the third largest fully equity house, right, in the Bay Area. Only ACT and Berkeley Rep are comparable.
Yeah.
So they're at the peak of this, and they look like they may be failing and not able to continue. And that was really massive to me. These others, you know, like LA, Oregon, not home, but TheaterWorks is right here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So long setup. What's wrong? Where have we gone wrong in the live theater world? Why is this happening?
You know, oh my gosh, this is a huge, huge question. ART this morning announced that they were shutting down their season as well. Another huge regional house. How do you get people back in the theater? How do you understand a changing business model? People aren't doing subscriptions. People want to do things at the last minute. You run a theater. I don't know what your subscriptions are. I don't know if they're up. I think it depends on where you live too and what kind of expendable capital you have. So that's been a big question. So subscriptions across the country are down. That model is just completely changing, if not dead, or it has to be part of your new way of thinking. How do you make people get in at the last minute? How do you do single ticket buyers? How do you get new people in? Who are your people coming to the theater? What kind of shows do they want to see? Are you listening to your audience to hear what they're saying? Are you listening to the news? Are you listening to both? It's really complicated for artistic directors who I think need to definitely listen to what's happening socially in the world and also listen to their audiences and know what their audiences want to see. I think in the pandemic, people got really used to staying at home and everything they need is in their house. So that's one part of that. The other interesting thing, and this is a pretty fascinating idea, and this was in American Theater Magazine, and you might have read this article, was that a lot of these big spaces are paying for space. So they have raised millions of dollars for capital campaigns to have space that then only belong to their theater. So they've got wasted revenue, they've got wasted time, they've got huge taxes that they have to pay. And so a great amount of the revenue that they need to have is not about programmatic, it's about actual space. Lucky Penny that you have is a community-based space. You welcome other groups in and other people in. And I think the conversation that's happening in the country is like, how do we share space? How do we share resources? Which is great for the environment, right? If you've got a billion props sitting in your prop warehouse, you need to monetize that. You need to figure out a way to share your props, share your costumes. Well, that takes a human making sure that that happens. But it doesn't do you any good if you've got a 14,000 square foot space just sitting there. It doesn't help you. You actually need to share the wealth. So a lot of people are now starting to talk about this new model, which is creating some like public space, not public space, but spaces that a lot of companies share. So they're all sharing scene shop space. They're all sharing property space. They're sharing costume shops, which I think is a smarter way to use your building. You know, and I know from some other local theaters when they're talking about programmatic, man, we only have X amount of shows and that theater is sitting dark. Why are we doing that? It's the same with Office Space, right? How, and I think the country is having sort of a come to Jesus moment about space, space usage, sharing resources. And so I think that's a huge part of it. When you look at it, you got to wonder how much money you're paying just for your physical space.
Sometimes I've penciled out with our little space here in Napa at Lucky Penny. If you think about the cost of rent, utilities, and insurance on a per day basis,
yeah,
like every day that goes by is costing this much.
Yeah.
And that's, say, 30 days a month, but there's only revenue coming in maybe 12 of those days.
Yep.
So that's kind of pointing to what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dead time. Nothing is going on. No money's coming in, but you still have to heat and cool to some degree. And yeah, the insurance has got to be paid whether anything happens or not, right?
Yeah.
So those are the really difficult issues people are going to be confronting. And I'm Godspeed to all of them to figure it all out, because the bigger you get, the harder that gets to solve.
It does. And you know, people want a beautiful space. You want to go to the leisure center. You want to be able to park. That's nice. That's wonderful. I had a season subscription to the Taper when I was at Cal State Fullerton. It was one of the seminal, you know, learning experiences of my life. There's nothing like going down there and being like, oh, there's the Amundsen and, you know, the Dorothy Chandler. I mean, you feel like you're in the middle of this great thing. That's a wonderful thing, but you can't sit dark all the time. But you have to figure out a way to share that space, that people aren't going to thrash your space, that people are going to actually use it and there'll be a revenue stream. And you also need, if you're going to do a show, you need time to be in your space for somebody to build, and to, you need to be in your space as the theater company. Yeah. So it's a real conversation that's happening about sharing. And I think it's a good conversation. I think that for theater to survive, about every 20 years, it's got to look at itself with new eyes.
Have a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's been surviving for 2,000 years, right? But it has gone through periods of hideousness and times like Broadway was almost dead in the 70s. Mm-hmm. What changes it, you know?
Yeah.
I also have one last thought on this. I really think to get people out of their house, you have to make it a party. And you have to offer more than just going to the theater. So a lot of people have liquor licenses. They have, you know, a coffee house that's attached to it. They have, which is surprising, because when you go to Theater Works, they have this wonderful little cafe. And so you have to, like, the example I always like to use is Ray of Light, which is in San Francisco. You know, it's in the middle of a sort of tough spot in town. It's in the Mission. And the theater is, you know, old. But I'll tell you, it feels authentic when you go in there. There's popcorn popping, they have a keg, you know, and you are going to like a rock show.
Yeah.
And how do you make the experience for your audience? How do you have it feel like something that is unique and special?
And something that stimulates you in a way that nothing on the television screen at home,
that's right,
will be able to do. Actual other human beings talking to you, interacting, the smells of popcorn, whatever it is.
And right? Sometimes I wonder if it's the show that matters. It's weird, you know, like I everyone's been like, show, the people, the show. And it's like, I don't know. I think it might be the experience.
Yeah.
Because you're going to see something live no matter what, and you're going to like it or you're not.
And you have to once in a while stop and ponder that question. Because, as you said, everything, including Broadway, can be on demand on your television.
Right.
Everything is
right
there. So what is it that compels someone to get up off the couch, get dressed, drive somewhere, pay a whole lot more than your whole month's subscription to Netflix to see one show?
Right.
It's right. It's the communal experience. It's not the show itself.
And there isn't anything like it. Even if you watch it on Broadway HD, there's nothing like it.
Like
you don't forget it. It's visceral. And I think there's ways to sell it. And I have these really weird ideas. Like, I think some theater companies should be like, easy parking. They should be like, if you're in San Francisco, we're clean, we're safe, right? Starbucks nearby. And I don't think that's really ridiculous. I think people want to know that there's ease, because we're dealing with ease. It's easy to walk to your to your living room. So how do you make ease and yet it be unique when you go?
How about every balcony seat comes with a free foot massage?
I'm there.
I'm just spitballing. Diane McBride, our guest in the Berry Pod this time around. It was everything I was hoping for, a little personality, a little issues. Good job.
A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants.
Thanks for being on the Berry
Thanks
Pod.
Thanks for having me.
This episode recorded on August 17th, 2023.
You're listening to the Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.